Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Michael Chaskalson, a master practitioner in mindfulness, who's practiced for over 40 years and pioneered bringing mindfulness into organisational life. He's the author of two books, Mindfulness in 8 Weeks and Mind Time, as well as having published many articles and podcasts on the subject of mindfulness. Michael was recognised for his work by Thinkers 50 in 2017, and as well as all his academic and business achievements, he's just a really nice person, interested in the quality of how we live our lives in a holistic sense. I was delighted when Michael agreed to come speak with me, and I hope you'll take inspiration in your relationship with mindfulness, wherever it may be or whatever it may look like. Michael describes mindfulness as developing the capacity to stay present with our own experience, the inner as well as the outer. And he describes his entry to mindfulness as a route to discovering what was happening in his mind and how that was shaping his experience. And the connection between thinking and feeling and sensing and how they shape our experience of the world. And through his mindfulness practice, he could more consciously have a different experience with the world around him. This past year or more, you know, many of us have considered some deeper questions about ourselves, our role, our identities, whether in relation to our families or our work and even, you know, wider society. And during such turbulent or uncertain times, you know, the temptation is in some ways to kind of block out, avoid, you know, who hasn't had that glass of wine or that extra pick-me-up of caffeine. But what I've found through this period is that mindfulness actually helps me to focus on what is, rather than trying to interpret or control the experience that I'm having, particularly when things feel less clear, less certain, and more out of my control. I've been practicing with integrating a practice into my everyday life, which, you know, some days has been 10 minutes, sometimes I've got to 20 minutes, many days I've had no minutes. And I've really just tried paying attention to my relationship with mindfulness and why it is that I find it hard to give myself 10 minutes really in a day. You know, it's not a lot of time. But as a working mum, you know, with lots going on, finding that time to really dedicate to yourself and just to focus on what is feels precious and not always achievable. And, you know, one of the things that Michael said to me years ago now was, you know, one of the cores in mindfulness is non-judgment. And I realized that I was judging how well or not I actually did mindfulness, sort of the antithesis of what mindfulness is trying to do. But it was such a relief. Michael talks about it not needing to be anything other than what it is, to let what is the case be the case because it is. And at the core, it's a deeply profound acceptance of the present moment without judgment. And he, in this episode, talks about when we can embrace, like really embrace what actually is, then it releases the creativity for the future. And I think for me, there's something in organisational life that this is so important for, kind of now more than ever. is the acceptance of what is that allows us then to move and to think about the future in a different way. In the episode, we explore what the mind adds to our experience, and we get to see this more clearly through a practice like mindfulness. And often the mind, and this is sort of something that we're all, have in common, adds a layer that often is judgment and suffering. It's the psychological addition that we, we're so programmed for it, we don't even notice it's happening. And mindfulness as a practice helps us to learn and to see when that's happening is just thoughts. It's not our truth, it's not the fact, and allows us to move the attention somewhere else. You know, how does this show up at work? Well, Michael encourages us to learn our own stress signature, being able to recognize our physiological signs of when we're feeling under stress. And you'll recall we talked about the neurobiological or biochemical signs, speaking with Tibisai Vera on episode 8. When we're stressed, we get tunnel vision and it's harder to think imaginatively and creatively or to connect with other people. You know, all things that, as we think of organizational life ahead, that we need to consider how to do well. So we talk about what mindfulness means both for leaders as individuals and at the collective level for teams, where the attention is on the experience of being within the team itself. And we talk about how we can facilitate this work, which is in the moment, and the importance of the leader being able to enable a container that's sort of strong enough to withstand us being able to encounter ourselves and, of course, them encountering themselves in this work. And the practices that we need to cultivate to enable that to happen. You know, really simple stuff in many ways, but complex when it shows up between people. How we listen, how we build on others' ideas, how we inquire and notice when we diminish, deplete or defend. Perhaps as you listen to the episode, it'd be helpful to keep a couple of questions in mind. What's your own experience of staying or being present in a moment and your awareness of what's happening? And what does your thinking add to the experience? And as we shift from considering individual mindfulness practice to the collective at the team level, how might team awareness help your team in relation to noticing awareness and dynamics? It was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. So welcome, Michael, to Team Time Table Talks. Fabulous to have you here. Can you do a little intro to yourself and just tell us a bit about you, what mindfulness is, and why is it important to you?
Whoa, okay. So I'm very happy to talk about that, and I can certainly go on at length about this sort of stuff. So I encountered mindfulness myself back in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, before it was ever a thing. I was studying a degree in philosophy and wasn't satisfied with the kind of approach that was being taken by my teachers at that time. I came upon a Buddhist center in the town I was in, and it blew me away. It just seemed to me to be answering the questions that I had. It seemed subtle, penetrating, and wise. And I learned to meditate. And the meditation practice really, really changed my life. I realized that, I'd embarked on a degree in philosophy in order to try to come to some new understandings. For me, it was a real practical matter. There were questions that I had. And these questions weren't being met on the course, but I saw that now there was a route. Mm. Especially there was a route to discover how what was happening in my mind was shaping my experience.
Mm.
So I wanted to see how the flows of thinking, feeling, sensing that were apparently internal were in fact shaping the external world I was experiencing. And more than that, I could begin to get some kind of handle on this. this. By working with these factors more consciously, I could learn to shape my experience differently and come into a different kind of relationship with the world around me. And maybe, just maybe over time, come to some kind of insight and understanding of what's actually going on out there. So this seemed to me, Debbie, at the time to be probably the most important question. I thought anything else that I decide to do with my life is subsidiary to this. I've got to get on top of this one before anything else. So I dedicated my life to it.
And it's interesting because in some ways, and if I talk about my own relationship with mindfulness, I mean, it's been a journey probably of 5 years, and I still very much regard myself as a beginner. I have actually come to you on a number of occasions where it's sort of like, and again, I've lost my practice, and again. And I think in some ways, you know, as you describe it, it sometimes feels such a big question, such a big thing. And yet we're trying to integrate a practice into a daily, everyday life. And I guess I'm curious how, when people are coming to mindfulness, how do we not get scared by this sort of like intensity, you know, the just overwhelming at times sense of, and also it's not just that it's it feels big to know this and therefore a bit overwhelming, but that somehow that there's a way to do it. And that if we don't get it right, we're somehow missing out. And maybe that's even worse. Just, is there something that you could talk about just in terms of how we come to discovering mindfulness and why it's important, relevant to how we live today?
Oh, that's so helpful. That's so useful. Look, the thing is, firstly, I want to distinguish between two factors. One is mindfulness itself. And the other one is mindfulness meditation. So they're different. And mindfulness meditation stands to mindfulness itself in the same way you could say that fitness stands to exercise. We exercise in order to get fit. We do mindfulness meditation in order to be more mindful. Okay. Now, I believe there's no ultimate limit to how mindful you might want to be. You know, you could just be more and more and more mindful. And by being mindful, I mean developing this capacity to stay present with experience in each moment. Just to be with what's here. And that doesn't necessarily mean being with what's here physically. It might mean being with what's here in your own mind, for example. So before anyone says, but hang on, I need to be able to think and project into the future and wonder about the past. I don't want to always be present. Yes, but you can mindfully engage in speculation, for example. You can mindfully engage in planning and in dreaming, for example. You can mindfully engage in recollection. It's simply knowing what you're doing when you're doing it. Being awake to what's actually happening right now. So there's no limits to the extent of wakefulness. There might in a way be a tipping point. And this is an interesting question, which is much debated actually in mindfulness and probably Buddhist circles as well. That, you know, is there a tipping point where you can actually talk about really having woken up as opposed to the state of not having woken up? And I'm not going to go into that in this conversation. I'll just note that it's there. So there's no limit here.
And just, you know, contextualizing your response in relation to the last year, there's an aspect of me, if I'm really honest, that says, I don't know if I want to waken up more to my experience of the last year. And again, it's sort of, for me, it's kind of getting to the root of, when we're more mindful. And I realized what I've done in the last probably 3 to 5 years is learn to respond to my own anxiety, nervousness, whatever, not through distraction and caffeine, but by actually bringing more attention to, so what's going on? What is it about? But the last 12 months, there has just been so much going on out there, in here, within the home, within the work, that at times it's felt over, I guess that word again, overwhelming to pay attention to it.
Yeah. Oh, that's very important. Again, you make such useful points. The point is this, it's not so much paying attention to inner reaching out to it, taking hold of it, focusing on it sort of way always. There's a way of being with what's here, which is open, allowing, expansive, non-grasping, and not needing it to be anything other than it is. But that's really crucial. It's this capacity to let what's here be what's here, to let what is the case be the case, because it is.
It's
inescapable. Every moment of this last year has been inescapably what it was. It is what it is. It simply was. There really was no getting away from it.
And
you know, we can all get into, and I get into, you know, chocolate, caffeine, Netflix. I don't want this. Fine. That's the case. That's what's here now. This not wanting is what's here.
So it's not denying what is here.
Exactly.
Nor, and one thing you said to me months and months ago, if not a year ago, was, and it was kind of for me a bit of an aha moment, which was to let go of the sense of responsibility that I was to judge the quality of how mindful I was being.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was that moment of saying, oh, I don't need to make sure that I'm doing it right. And it was just that sense of, it's not, you know, it's kind of the antithesis of judging. And yet we're so well programmed to judge in many ways because we're justifying our precious time. And so, by golly, it better be worthwhile. And so I think we do bring in an eight. You know, I want this to be worthwhile and to add value and et cetera, et cetera. And yet at the core of this is non-judgment.
Yeah. At the core of it is a profound, radical, deeply radical willingness to let this moment be what it is. It doesn't mean the future or the past. Well, so the past's gone. Nothing we can do about it. The future, we cannot shape, but we can orient towards. The present is what it is. It is like this. When we can embrace that, then the way we orient ourselves to the future can be more or less creative. It's like this. Now what? It's like this. Now what would be best? What would be best for me? What would be best for others? What would be best for the context I'm in?
But
it is like this. And if you can't stand in the actuality and what's actually here, then the what's next is going to be shaky. You're going to be wonkily off into whatever comes next. When you can allow yourself to be here with whatever it is, then your next step is going to be more appropriate. It's going to be tuned to reality just that bit more.
That does resonate for me. And it often, I think, feels safer to either be in the future or in the past rather than with dealing with and paying attention. And the word that really sort of sits for me is, am I willing to encounter myself now as I am? And so just that quality of encountering oneself. And one of the concepts, you know, without getting too sort of like theoretical, but one of the concepts that really brought insight for me was that of adventitious suffering. So what our mind does to whether a negative or even positive experience that adds a layer of suffering that in our minds is just so much, I think, we are used to, you know, dealing with what are we worried about and how much of it is actually the psychological addition rather than the actual what is now.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I encounter this a lot when I'm teaching people meditation. So remember, meditation isn't the same as mindfulness. It's
yep.
a practice yep. to increase mindfulness. But when I'm teaching meditation, especially to busy people and people who are wired to be productive in every moment and to make every minute count and to mm-hmm. look for value, a 10-minute meditation can feel unendurably long.
Mm.
And, you know, sitting there with one's own mind for 10 minutes can feel boring, difficult, overwhelming, and no end to these. But here's the important thing. Every one of those thoughts or judgments is only a thought.
Mm.
Sitting there going, oh, I'm so bored, that's just a thought.
Mm.
Or sitting there going, oh, this is really hard, it's just a thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what people learn with mindfulness meditation is to recognize thoughts as thoughts.
Mm.
Oh, this is so difficult. Hang on. That's just a thought. And then there's the capacity to move attention elsewhere. So that's just a thought. Move my attention to the experience of breathing, which is what the instruction was, say, in this case. So move attention to the experience of breathing. One breath, two breaths. Thoughts crop up. Thoughts about the to-do list, thoughts about other things. Recognize them as thoughts. Accept that that's what's going on. Come back to the breath. Mm. Over and over and over again. So we're learning to see thoughts as thoughts, which means that all these thoughts about the pandemic, about ourselves, about other people, the judgments we're making, they're just adventitious additions that create our own suffering.
Mm.
So the thought, this is so hard, it's just something I've added into my experience, which is making me less happy.
Yeah.
I don't have to do this to myself. I can just stay with what it actually is, which isn't hard. It's just breathing.
Mm. And Because through my own practice, I have noticed the tendencies and patterns of my mind. I have noticed I tend to go forward. I don't spend much time in the past. I spend more time in the future and probably more in the planning or perhaps worrying about something that's yet to be planned. And I have found it helpful to kind of come back to, so what's actually relevant and present now? And how much is it actually just that tendency to, oh, there it's gone again. Oh, there it's gone again. But this is, I mean, so yes, it's got something fundamental in terms of being more aware of our thoughts and how much we give our mind in that thinking control over what we do, but it also has physical and physiological elements as well. In terms, I'm thinking of cortisol in particular, and again, you know, I think, you know, there's been times in organizations where, you know, I think stress is worn as a badge of pride, you know, who's works the hardest, the longest, you know. And yet we know that, particularly with something like cortisol, it's got peaks and valleys. It's good for us to have healthy levels of stress, short bursts, but that we also need the valley for it to come down. And if it doesn't in the evening, nighttime, we know that it can have negative effects. But can you say something about the physiological aspects of mindfulness and you know, how we live our lives in today's world?
Oh, that's so interesting. So yes, I mean, the adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, they all get activated in all of us all of the time. And as you say, you know, some of the time that produces good stress.
Yeah.
Gets us going, gets us moving, gets us doing stuff. But if it doesn't, if we don't manage it differently, then it turns into distress. We end up in bad places. Now, with mindfulness, we learn methodologies that enable us to move towards the experience of eustress. We can feel the tightening in our jaw, feel the clenching in our stomach, feel the butterflies, and then have strategies that we can use to actually manage these differently.
Mm.
And one of these is the engagement of curiosity and interest.
Mm.
Yeah. So we notice butterflies in the stomach. I'm about to go on talk to 500 people on, let's say, I'm going to talk to 500 people on Zoom, and I'm not quite sure I'm totally prepared. And am I really ready? Will this be okay? Will this be okay? Is it going to be good enough? And I can feel the butterflies in my tummy. Now, if I'm going, oh my God, I'm really stressed. Things are going to get more and more problematic in terms of the drivers that are taking me into this. If at that moment I go, oh, wow, butterflies, that's interesting. This actually feels like butterflies. They're like fluttery. Wow, it's like as if, yeah, they say butterflies. It's as if I've got a belly full of butterflies. How weird is that? You're in a different place now.
Mm.
Now you're in a place of resourcefulness, inquiry. You've activated your parasympathetic nervous system as opposed to the sympathetic nervous system. You've brought about, in that moment of shift, you've engaged a whole bunch of processes that are more, in this case, more benign.
Mm.
So you're going to bring down levels of cortisol. You're going to bring down levels of adrenaline and noradrenaline. You're going to open to different physiological components, which are going to enable you to move into the situation, I believe, with more resourcefulness. Now, that doesn't mean that the previous activation was bad. The previous activation was helpful, and now we can move forward activated differently.
Yeah. I think the, you know, just to use the example you gave, they call it the amygdala hijack, don't they? Where, you know, that sort of intense stress reaction, which of course is in some ways positive. It gets us sort of aware. But with too much flooding of the body, we're actually shutting down the ability to think and to stay present if we don't find a way to kind of bring those levels or to moderate those levels. And I think, because it's interesting, I suspect people listen and say, God, I'd never think about butterflies whilst they're happening if I've got, you know, if I'm 10 minutes on. And yet, so it feels a little counterintuitive, but actually it's been sort of evidenced scientifically in terms of being able to bring that prefrontal cortex back on stream, if you like, back online, by moderating what is a physiological response. But we get signals for that.
Well, if we can learn our stress signatures,
yeah,
learn our own stress signatures, then we know that when we're experiencing these, it's very likely that we're getting tunnel visioned.
Yes.
It's very likely that non-essential neural circuits are now shutting down. And it means we're finding it harder to think imaginatively and creatively and responsively and to connect with other people.
Yeah.
Right now, all we're doing is fight, run.
Yeah.
That's what's available. Freeze, fight, run. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what those chemicals are doing to us. And, you know, right at that point, it'd be great if we also got a capacity to have a different response, which is more oxytocin-driven, more willing to engage with the people. Then, now, this is much harder in the virtual world. You know, we're looking at, in the case I've given, little postage stamps on screen.
Yeah.
But if you can focus, get your attention into the fact that these are actual people, this is a living situation, what can I do that's really helpful for them?
Yeah.
What would be the most useful thing to say and do right now for them? Then you're going to be on your game. How do you get to that place? You get to that place by, first of all, acknowledging the stressor in yourself, and secondly, allowing it, getting interested in it for a micro moment or two. That's what I'm talking about here. Yeah. Just, oh yeah, wow, butterflies.
Okay. So we're not saying go off and do a 10-minute podcast. We're saying pay attention to the felt experience. Pay attention and recognize, as you say, your stress signature. You know, and I certainly can think, what are the things that I start to do or start to notice that tells me, oh, okay, now you're starting to feel a bit anxious, a bit stressed. And I know that, you know, that has an effect on my ability to stay focused, attentive, my memory, you know, all the things that we really rely on in high stress situations. You're saying pay attention and bring a micro awareness to your experience.
Notice what's happening now. Now.
Right. Yeah.
Just really micro. Now. Nothing could be more micro than now. But here's the thing. When you've learnt your stress signature, then you can recognize stress as stress.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so important.
Maybe we could turn our attention to mindfulness with leaders. And if we can start with leaders as individuals, but also to understand what mindfulness is in relation to a team.
Right. Well, I'll just make a distinction here, because I think that there's something really interesting that happens when we make the shift from individuals to teams. So there's some really, really valuable stuff that leaders as individuals can do for themselves, becoming more mindful. There are great outcomes as a result of doing that. Team mindfulness is a different matter. Team mindfulness is what happens when the team becomes aware of itself collectively. So the team is now, as it were, mindful. The team, there is some attention within the team to the team. The team itself is now willing to think of itself as a team, willing to think of what's happening within the team, willing to notice and able to discuss matters of team dynamics, as well as tasks, goals, and objectives, to talk about what it feels like to be here, what it's like to be a member of this team, and is willing to listen to members of the team who discuss that, willing to be non-reactively, non-judgmentally present with one another in those conversations. So a kind of team mindfulness emerges. Now, teams that can be mindful in that way are psychologically safer. They are better able to allocate tasks, I would say. They're better able to understand their collective purpose. They're better able to make judgments around their collective goals and objectives. That's all lovely. Individual mindfulness is a different matter. Individual mindfulness is the individual's capacity to pay attention in the moment, to let what is the case be the case, to be engaged, present, curious in their interactions with others and with the system of which they're a part. So it's a different matter, but there are really, really interesting overlaps. And I think one of the big overlaps is what we call AIM, an acronym. I know that the management world is too full of them.
Yep.
This acronym is Allowing Inquiry and Meta-Awareness. Allowing, we've spoken about, letting what is the case be the case. Mm. So this is about accepting reality for what it is. Leaders who can do this locate themselves in the present. It's like this. This organization is like this. This conversation is like this. I'm feeling like this. This is what's on our plate. This is what we need to deal with. This is what's here now. Or this is how I am today. And that's how she is right now. It's like this. Yeah. Inquiry is curious. Where are we going to go with this? What's up? What's this like? What does it actually feel like? What am I thinking about this? What are they thinking about this? What's on our radar? Interest, curious, present with each moment, continually mentally alive and looking into what's here.
Mm.
And then metta awareness is this capacity to step ever so slightly back from the situation and to see the experience you're having right now as just a flow of experience. So you don't, for example, mistake your thoughts for facts.
Yeah.
You know, there's an exercise that I'll often do in a mindfulness class where we set an example. You know, for example, there's an apartment or a house come up that you can just afford that would be so much better than the one you're in, and you make an offer and you're really excited, and the agent says they're going to call you back come close of play Friday. Right, so you're really excited. So the first setup is, imagine this, you've had a dreadful week, you're feeling lousy, you can't get on top of your in-tray, people just don't seem to get it right now. There've been lots of, you know, difficult conversations. Come close of play Friday, you don't get the call. What do you think? What do you feel? Okay, think about that for 10 seconds. Second setup, you've had a really great week, everything's going really well, you're getting on top of all your emails and messages, people really get it, everyone's working together harmoniously towards a great goal. Come close of play Friday, you don't hear back from the agent. What do you think? What do you feel? And the question I ask is just, is there any difference?
Mm.
And inevitably, you know, people will say, yeah, of course. You know, one week I felt like this, second week I felt like that. What this illustrates is that the way we think, feel, they're not facts.
Mm.
Because all we know is that an agent didn't call back. That's the facts.
Mm.
But out of these facts, we spin stories. And the stories we spin are shaped by what's gone before.
Mm.
In one mode of mind, we shape one set of stories. Another mode of mind, we shape another set of stories. And they're just stories.
Mm.
Just thoughts. They're just coming together of thinking, feeling, sensing, impulse. They're made of air. But we take them to be real. Now, meta-awareness is this capacity to step back and notice what you're up to.
Mm.
I'm just spinning a story here. Hang on. All I know is she didn't call back. That's it. That's all I know. Let's stay with that fact. Didn't call back. Okay. Don't spin off into proliferation.
Yeah.
So that capacity can be trained, and it's powerful. So allowing inquiry and meta-awareness, all three can be trained, and they make for a completely different approach to leadership.
Mm.
They enable a whole set of sub-capacities, and leaders who are more mindful, I'd suggest, are more powerful. Well, I don't want to use the word powerful at all. Leaders who are more mindful, I'd suggest, are more engaged, empathic, and effective.
Mm. And when I bring that into the team level and the work that I do with teams, some of the threads that I bring, one of them that I think is kind of the most important is working in the moment. And, you know, there's always this sort of tension, I think, when you're doing teamwork, that somebody or some part of the machine wants to know exactly what will play out, you know, for the day or half a day or 2 days. And so there's always a tension between having a planned frame, if you like, and actually knowing, I would say from experience, that what makes a difference is what will actually happen in the moment. Yes. And between the moments.
Yes.
On the day. Yes. And I think John Kabat-Zinn mentioned in The Mind's Own Physician, he says, attention and intention work beautifully together to further the possibility of waking up to the actuality of one's experience.
Yes.
And for me, with teams, it's the quality of attention together with the clarity of intention and just allowing that focus on what is rather than what we, you know, put on the agenda to get signed off just to get people in the room or on the Zoom. But that can, and I find it more so at a team level than at an individual level, because I think at a team level, there's so many more sets of dynamics that sort of test us as to how open and curious and vulnerable we may feel to all the other people. the AIM model and the concept of what mindfulness is here in terms of serving our capacity to better know ourselves as a team is incredibly important. And also, if I'm honest, I think people find it a bit nebulous. But what's the thing I'm going to learn? And what's the diagnosis you're going to give me? And what exercise will we do to get our values? Yeah. And yet we know that working in the moment and allowing attention to be brought to the quality of how we are is, in my view, the work.
Absolutely is. And what I'm hearing here, Debbie, is that you're actually in the moment, as a facilitator in the moment, what you're catalyzing is meta-awareness.
Mm.
By drawing attention to what's actually moving right now between us, you're catalyzing this capacity for the team to come to an aha understanding, to have some meta-awareness of itself as a team, to see what it's up to see how it functions. Now, that insight, that micro insight, is so powerful and so important. That can release so much creativity when people come to, that's how we do it. That's why we get into these knots. That's why some of us aren't signing up to this. That's why some people are just dialed in but not present. That's what's going on. Aha.
And I think because of the capacity for the aha, and you mentioned it's got the possibility of greater creativity, greater innovation, greater connection. But it's also got, I think, the fear of exposing pain or hurt or imposter syndrome or all the things that we as humans may do. In terms of wearing the mask or playing the games and, you know, all the stuff that we know happens, but do we really want it acknowledged? And so I think, and this goes back to your earlier point about psychological safety, you know, does it come first or second? In that, I would say, I think one of the leader's most important roles in this work is enabling a container that feels safe enough to build psychological safety. Psychological safety being something that comes from within the group. It can't be given, it can't be imposed, it's momentary, but that can feel incredibly exposing. And I guess one of the things that I think I'm curious about is, how do we do this work that has great upside, but sometimes a fear of great downside?
Yes. Yes. I mean, and this is, of course, the whole skill of facilitation, and not made any easier by being done virtually, because it's not always easy to read the screen in the same way one can read a room.
Yeah.
But this is the skill of the facilitator, to be able to somehow communicate a level of trustworthiness and containership. One will be here. I will hold this. Trust me. It will be okay. This is going to be okay. And together, we can do this thing. Together, we can allow this conversation to happen.
Mm.
No one's going to get hurt here. No one's going to be bullied. No one need be scared. Now, that, building that, creating that atmosphere is alchemical.
Mm.
There is no recipe. It depends on the facilitator's capacity to embody and express a kind of unconditional positive regard, a profound non-judgmental attitude, their capacity to observe in the moment and be with what's happening in the moment, picking up the nuances. Again, much harder in virtual context.
Mm.
Asking the appropriate questions. So, that, I mean, this is all, you know, the art of skilled facilitation, and I've got nothing to teach you about this. But I think that's, you know, what our task as facilitators and therefore it's also what leaders get from observing great facilitation at work, which is good enough facilitation at work.
So I think I have a slightly different view. I think I would have said 5 years ago, I think I would have entrusted more in the facilitator. I think what I've learned from some of the work that I've been doing is it absolutely is about the facilitator role modeling, what that sort of openness, curiosity, compassion, good listening, all this sort of underpinning behaviors. But my reticence to say it's only the facilitator is that it puts you up as being the barometer of, and actually it makes it very easy to either reject the facilitator. It's too difficult. It's too different. He doesn't get me. So what I've learned, and it's not to demean the role of the facilitator, but it's saying, look, we don't come in and do it for you. We are, and this is where I think it's sort of built on a dialogic process where our heavy lifting is actually having the team build the program and the principles that they want to work within, and identifying, we bring some of the techniques and tools and that eye to see what's happening. But actually, I think what I would now say is that we are co-owners of this process.
Yes.
I may play a more present figural role in the early days in terms of role modeling, container, and recognizing the process that we're in. But for me, one of the success criteria is that transitions that capacity transitions to within the team itself.
Absolutely.
And the other thing that I learned through experience, you know, we wear the scars of, you know, we wear the badges and we wear the scars, is being sufficiently aligned. You know, we'd like to think within the team we all have equal space, equal rights, etc. But we know if there's a leader that there is power, hierarchy, authority, etc. involved. And so there's something for me about the alignment of this work, this team, the facilitator with the leader and his or her expectations, but also in terms of how much they're willing to encounter themselves in this work. And when and if, you know, so there's what people are up for and what we'll say, agree to, but often the work is in the moment. And if we see the leader closing an encounter or finding it very difficult to remain in encounter, I have seen that that's had profound impact on what the team has felt possible. And again, it kind of takes it away from saying, yes, we play a pivotal role, but actually the team and the leader are as important in that sort of triangle.
Oh, totally. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with anything. There's one small nuance that I would draw attention to, and I don't know what, I doubt that you're going to disagree with this, but I'm inclined not to talk about role modeling anything. I'm more inclined to talk about embodying. So this needs to be embodied. The capacity to listen needs to come from a deep willingness to listen, not role modeling listening, but listening. And allowing comes again from, you know, a deep capacity to embody an allowing attitude. Not role modeling allowing, but actually genuinely in the moment allowing.
I think where the role modeling comes in is where you have, say, a team who are comfortable with each other, but that the there's sort of underlying tensions of disagreement, unresolved, really quite critical questions that the team need to find some peace on. I think in some ways it was how that the role modeling came from. How do we ask challenging questions with respect, with compassion, that allows, and one of my sort of big things is the tendency we have to polarize our thinking and our acting. You know, something's good or bad, you know, it's this way or it's that way. And of course, it's never as clear as that. So how do we allow those and conversations? And so the role modeling was in how we do that in a way that honors, acknowledges, respects, but also brings it to the fore. But it's not, it's not to set ourselves up as being better at, or, you know, and I think that's one of the bubbles that gets popped quite soon, is this is not about bringing in experts in, you know, it's about bringing in experience of working with these tensions, dynamics, in a way that allows that team to make greater sense of their experience.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, one of the absolute cornerstones of my own work is the notion that minds are alike.
Mm.
So I'm helping people, I'm introducing people to some ways of working with the mind. And my way of working with this is to recognize that my mind is no different.
Mm.
Yeah. So what you're saying about your experiences will have echoes in my own experience. And how I may have addressed some of this in my own experiencing may have echoes in your own experiencing.
Mm.
But let's get into a conversation about how we can do this.
Mm.
Yeah, based on not that I'm the expert telling you how to do it, but this isn't the issue that we face.
Absolutely.
How do we address this issue?
I've certainly felt the difference when a team has, and this, you know, it's an odd term to use, but when a team is at flow,
yes,
there is a quality of collectiveness. Is there such a thing as a team mind?
Ha ha. Now that's really interesting. There's another way of figuring the question, which is that is there such a thing as a team experience?
Mm.
Come back to that idea. So to the extent that there is more shared experience in the team, to the extent that there is more shared experience, to that extent we can begin to talk about team experience.
Mm.
This is a shared experience. This is what it's like for us to be here. And we all recognize it in one another. We see that when we're in this place of flow, that we're now experiencing alike somewhat.
Mm.
And therefore, we can talk about a kind of shared experience. We're sharing an experience. You know, I mean, you get that, you know, in music concerts when people are all intent on the music in certain ways. Classical audiences will experience in one way, rock audiences will experience in a different way. But what they're experiencing in whatever way is the commonality, the shared humanity of their being there going through this experience. And so, yeah, I think there is such a thing as shared experience. Of course, it's not perfectly shared because not everybody is fully self-transcendent in the moment. There will be elements that are unique to each individual. But to the extent that there's something powerfully combining going on, then there is also something shared. So you kind of think of Venn diagrams, if you like. You know, you can have a number of different bubbles all around the edge of a shared experience, or you can have very little shared experience and just a whole bunch of individual bubbles colliding or even bouncing off each other.
Yeah.
So, and so we build this image that's just come to mind, and it starts to be the idea that, you know, some of these bubbles can be more porous and more permeable. People can soften their edges with one another, be less focused on their own defensiveness, more engaged in the task, to the extent that they're in flow individually, to that extent they're engaged in the task individually, to that extent their boundaries are going to be more permeable, to the extent that they're doing this together, there'll be more shared experience.
Mm.
So lovely, there's a lovely link there between flow, permeability, sharedness.
Yeah, I think this is, for me, a really important area. You know, often teams can, or leaders of teams can present saying we just don't know each other that well. There's not great degrees of trust. We just need to get to know each other. And it's still at the individual level. And there is something for me about this interconnectivity between feeling more heard, being more seen as the individual, and how it's accepted or acknowledged at the team level.
Yes.
And we've used I've used musical experience with teams before as a way of creating some sense of shared experience, rather than coming in with my individual experience. We do something together that ultimately creates this memory. But I think one of the things that I've also learned over the years is the team experience, the team memory, the team mind is momentary. It's not permanent. There's shifts in time,
yes.
External influences, very much, you know, when we've got new team members coming in or team members leaving, it changes that sense of who we are as a team and our experience as a team. And it's one of these things I think people want to say, you know, we've done it, we're past that, rather than just acknowledge, actually, this is just about how you are always, you know, how you are together, creating new team memories rather than that day that we did, you know, whatever we happened to do.
Right. That's of course. And you've sparked a whole useful set of thoughts in me, Debbie, which I'm going to think more about and work with. This notion of the relationship between flow and optimal team performance, and the notion that there can be team flow, and that therefore this process of team flow at its best, which you can, you know, give people a taste of in collective music making, perhaps, or other activities, isn't something that you can preserve in aspic. It's something that you have to create and recreate and recreate and recognize that there are conditions for flow.
Yeah.
So what are the conditions for flow? There's going to be something around resourcefulness and challenge. You know, that we mustn't be under our own, working within our capacity too much or beyond our capacity too much. That beautiful line between them. So that applies to the team and to its members. We mustn't overstretch any members, overwork any members, or understretch, underwork any members. We as a team mustn't look for comfort all the time, but let's look for a bit of stretch. But let's not overstretch for too long. So there's a whole bunch of factors that we can talk about in terms of team flow, but then also recognizing that every circumstance is going to require a reconstruction or re-emergence in flow. It's never created, it's never a one-off, but it's something that we can aim for if we have non-judgmental conversations that can discuss what it's like right now.
Yeah.
Then we can recognize when we're out of it. And we can think about what we need to do to get back into it.
Yeah. And that just to kind of bring it to the pragmatic, that for me is the value and beauty of things like process pauses, where we are deliberately bringing ourselves out of the content that often is so alluring, but to notice how we were, you know, how fired up we got, how open we were to hearing different points of view, how much we listened or built or diminished or defended. And I think the word for me that resonates is cultivating the practices that enable the conditions for flow.
Yes.
And that being, when we say working with teams, I think it is awareness and inquiring and meta-awareness, and it's cultivating those conditions that enable that flow to happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's something that I know from my own experience is that mindfulness and flow aren't the same, but they are mutually supportive. That when one is more mindful, one finds it easier to enter flow states. When one is more frequently encountering flow states, one finds it easier to enter mindful states. They're mutually supportive, and I'm sure it's the case in teams as well.
Mm. Yeah. If I could slightly change the tack and ask you, what have you learned about yourself as you bring this work to organizations?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I've certainly learned something about my own ambition. It turns out to be, in a certain way, fairly driven, actually. I'm quite ambitious. I do want to... I'm not satisfied with the way things are. It pains me to think about the waste of life, of presenteeism, of 9-to-5-ism, of people just showing up for a paycheck and being expected to go through the motions. It pains me to think about the way in which people are abused in organizations. I really would love to make a difference. And I'm very aware of my incapacity sometimes to shift a system and the frustration of that. You know, how painful it can be to see people hurting and being hurt in organizations, and wasting and being wasted in organizations, and feel my inability to do it. And I really can sometimes feel up against that.
It's interesting. So you talk the incapacity to shift the system, and yet, of course, there's a recognition that none of us as individuals have the ability to shift the system. But what, you know, being really thoughtful to where we focus our time and attention, where it increases the likelihood of there being a shift, whether it's because there's more people doing it or whether it was because it was the right intervention with where power lies. I love hearing ambition and driven, because I think, you know, at its most sort of throwaway, people can be a bit disparaging of mindfulness, you know, soft and floaty and, you know, and yet actually you bring a real pragmatism to wanting to make a difference in how we are at work, in how we organize, you know, in the various systems in our life. And for me, that's so important. What advice would you give to leaders wanting to bring or introduce mindfulness to their teams?
Interesting. I would suggest that they start with themselves for a start. This isn't something they're going to do to others, but they need to recognize that they have to face their own minds in the process. So, you know, put a little bit of time into being with your own mind each day, even 5 minutes, 10 minutes. 10 better than 5. So that's the first bit. Be willing to be with your experience. And the second bit, recognize that not everybody's going to get it or want it.
Mm.
Be gentle, be delicate, and allowing.
Mm.
Create an open invitation. See what happens.
Mm. Oh, I love that one. And I have heard actually of people in organizations, whether they just, you know, book a meeting room over lunchtime for those that want to come and share in the experience of mindful practice, in whatever that means to them, and people feeling just that sense of companionship in this. And I think companionship in something like mindfulness is actually really important.
It's hugely supportive, and you know, you create these sort of little networks of people who kind of get something together and are able to have conversations of certain sorts together.
Mm.
And therefore the little sort of seed crystals through the organization that can begin to catalyze different kinds of conversation.
Mm. And that in itself is, you know, quite a nice analogy with what can happen within teams, that if there's, you know, only that one person that's talking about something that feels quite different and quite out there, it can sometimes, certainly if it's not the team leader, it can end up just not going anywhere. But with those seeds that are connected, with the curiosity to invite, well, what was your experience of that same thing? Then I think you elevate teams to the potential in quality of connection, insight, foresight, you know, in a way that if we stay just with ourselves and our own individual experience, doesn't seem to get there.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So by way of closing, Michael, I'm going through a sort of similar format. And the first is to ask you whether you have what I'm calling a micro practice. And by that, I mean sort of just a small practice that people could take and use with their own teams, in the spirit of a micro practice that might improve our human experience of working in teams.
Right. Okay. So one of the most useful things you can do, especially in the current situation, is to recognize that people are spending so much time in meetings. And people will often come to a meeting having just done something and leave a meeting leaping into the next thing with no pauses in between. So just enabling a pause, a collective pause, and it can be literally 1 minute, a 1 minute micro meditation. Now, you could time that with a timer, or you could do it yourself. You could just sit quietly and count X breaths over a timed minute. So you set a minute timer running at some point and just breathe in, breathe out, count one, breathe in, breathe out, count two, breathe in, breathe out, count three. Do that until the timer pings. That's how many breaths you take in a minute, in a mindful minute, in a meditative minute. So you could just say, let's just take a minute and then just count 6, 8, 10, whatever it is, 15 breaths, and then say, right, let's go. And you could talk to people about this, that this is a timed minute, this is how it goes, and people might find it useful in other parts of their lives.
Mm.
That could be useful.
Thank you. Two final questions. What are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
Do you know, I think this pandemic is causing us to rethink the whole way in which we do work.
Mm.
It's causing us to rethink the workplace, the work context, so many different things. So I don't think there's any chance that we're just going to spring back to the status quo ante. We're just not going to.
Mm.
What comes next, I don't know, but it's not going to be what went before.
Mm.
And I'm hopeful that there are enough voices out there saying we can do this differently, that we can do it better, whatever it's going to do.
I entirely agree. I can't imagine that we go back to what it was. We've learned too much. We've experienced a difference too much. And one of the areas that I'm really interested in is understanding what the organization needs, what the individual wants, and how it shows up at the team level and how one navigates what will become, I think, a hybrid working model, and what that means for how we connect, how we flow, how we innovate, etc.
Absolutely. The team is the fundamental working unit of most organizations. So absolutely. And so enabling team conversations where that can take place would be very, very powerful.
Yeah. Last question. How can we be more helpful in our teams?
Listen, 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 listen. You can't do too much listening. Listen to each other. Really listen. Really listen. Don't think you're listening enough. You never are. Listen some more.
I love the sort of different layers that we have of listening, and that, you know, if we listen for understanding or listen with compassion rather than listening to reload. And I think we're probably all guilty of just waiting for somebody to probably just pause to take a breath, frankly, and see that as, I've probably done it on this interview, to see that as our in. And yet if we really stay with our listening in service of the other, what might happen as a consequence?
Yeah, absolutely.
And finally, Michael, what inspires you?
Oh, I've got a poem. I didn't think about this, but here's a poem. So it's called The Guest House by Rumi. So it's a Sufi poet of the medieval era. So he goes, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." Now, for me, I'm not sure about a guide from beyond, but I'm sure about each has been sent as an indicator of our common humanity. This is what it's like to be human. These dark thoughts, the shame, the malice. Let them in. We're human. It's okay. We're in this together, all of us. It's okay. Let it be. Just like this.
And the reality is, they're in whether we invite them in or not.
Absolutely. Being human is a guest house.
Fabulous. Yes. Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a fantastic conversation. We've woven and weaved, and I think mindfulness plays such an important role in self-discovery, and the quality of our awareness of ourself deeply impacts the quality of our experience at the team level and the organizational level. So thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's been great.
Well, I hope you find this episode as thought-provoking and nourishing as I did. Michael describes mindfulness as subtle, penetrating and wise. And it's how I experience him too. I find talking with Michael nourishes my soul and reinvigorates my relationship with mindfulness. And through his wonderful companionship. Thank you, Michael, for your generosity and commitment to your practice and in our conversation. And how did you get on with your questions? Perhaps you might take a moment to consider again your relationship with the present moment and your quality of awareness of what's happening now, like actually right now, and how team mindfulness might help your team in the quality of its noticing, awareness and dynamics. Details of how to get in touch with Michael and any references from this episode are on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Time Table Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.